Welcome to the Wellness and Wahala podcast. This is a podcast for wellness and Wahala warriors who are a winner, world changer, wise, and winsome. They are dedicated to tackling Wahala, which means issues and problems in Nigerian pidgin, for the good of humanity. Our tribe of subject matter experts in our village are a voice to the voiceless. Like you know, the African proverb, it says it takes a village. So we have a tribe of supporters that we will be interviewing on our show. Oya, join me, the former diplomat and public health advisor, Dr. Tomi Ademokun, better known as Oma Oba, as I give you the best public health and wellness in Wahala gist with wonderful people and guests, my VIPs, using their compassion to take action to put us on a pathway to a Wahala-free life. Bless up. Hi, how are you?
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. The Wellness and Wahala podcast. You all, you're hearing the voice of our VIP guest today. Thank you. Calling in all the way from Nigeria. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Hello, everybody.
Thank you for having me. No, it is a great honor to have you. Today we have a special VIP guest, one of my hometown Nigerian heroes. Her name is Alhari Bawa Magaji. And she has a wonderful bio, y'all, okay? She is in humanitarian service. She's a director of RADI, R-A-D-I, which stands for Resilient Aid and Dialogue Initiative. She is passionate humanitarian and an advocate for social equality and an entrepreneur who has been at the forefront of intervening for vulnerable people. With two master's degrees from the Eastern Mediterranean University. I'm telling y'all, she's a stunner. North Cyprus and valuable working experience as a researcher, gender specialist with the Centers for Women's Studies in North Cyprus. She brings valuable experience to RADI, working with internally displaced people, IDPs, and empowering them in Nigeria. She is also the country facilitator for Revealing Light Ministries, a trauma healing organization. Welcome.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
So I would just kick off this show by saying that, you know, it's a great honor to have you. I know that I have been working in Nigeria for many years. I was referred to you by one of my good friends and colleagues, Safia, and yes. The IDP crisis in Nigeria has been, you know, for over a decade now. But unfortunately, especially being here, a Nigerian in the diaspora in America, many people still do not know that Nigeria has millions, like over 2 million at that time. It's probably up to like 8 million now, but internally displaced people in Nigeria. So it's great to have you. My first question to you is, what is your biggest accomplishment in the humanitarian field of saving lives in Nigeria? Over to you, Ma.
Hello. Before I start, I also want to say I'm honored to be here and be able to be on here. Thank you so much. My biggest accomplishment, I'll have to say, will always be just seeing someone breaking a smile from the hope that, you know, whatever intervention we're doing at the time provides for the person. Because, you know, putting yourself in their shoes, you have to remember, these are people who most times they're asleep when the attacks happen or they're in church. It's usually, you know, it happens and you're losing limbs, you're losing loved ones, you're losing your home. And then nobody is telling you what to do, where to go. Neighbors and friends that are supposed to come in to help are also going through the same thing, you know. It's sometimes the whole village, so they're just left helpless and hopeless. So being able to go there and see them and take clothes, and then, you know, or going to the hospital and seeing someone who has been discharged but can't go home because he can't pay his bills, and, you know, it makes them feel like there's no government, like there's nobody, absolutely nobody who cares. So seeing that smile when they get help is everything. That has to be, for me, giving hope is my biggest achievement. Like it's I can't think of anything that gives me more satisfaction.
Yes. That's, you know, bringing joy to people, especially in this Wahala world, I would say that we're in. People face a lot of issues and challenges. Yes. And I also believe that this past 3 years, you know, this unprecedented COVID-19 pandemic has even brought more crisis, you know, health crisis on top of the humanitarian crisis that people are facing. And you said a key thing, you know, about government. You know, we just finished an unprecedented, you know, election in Nigeria. And even before then, the administration, many administrations, I lived through at least three of them when I was serving in Nigeria, has not really came to the aid of those that are most vulnerable, which leads me to my second question is, what is the hardest lessons, you know, you have learned in this field, you know, of dealing with this humanitarian crisis and seeing people in very deep pain? Over to you.
My hardest lessons have to be, I didn't know the extent to which people were left to cater to themselves in a situation like this. Mm-hmm. You know, many people assume, I mean, the government knows an attack happened. So obviously a government is supposed to move in and take the wounded to the hospital, provide where those whose houses have been burnt to sleep. None of this happened ever. The only time in 2020 that I know that government intervened and helped was when there even had to be a Twitter campaign by Stephen Kelfas and Dr. Jonathan Fulani. So they kept tagging, you know, government agencies. There's National Emergency Management Agency, there's the state, SEMA and NEMA. And they kept tagging them, and that's when relief materials were brought. But you see, these are people who lost everything. You bring a bag of rice, a little 5 kg bag of rice, it finishes, and then what happens? You know, there's no plan on ground. And that was a hard lesson for me to accept, that a government would literally do nothing and leave people sleeping on the bare floor with kids. You know, we've had a number of people who died as a result of the after effects of the attacks not being handled well. You know, we've had people, many, I can't count the number of people whose limbs had to be amputated because they didn't have 1,000 naira to treat the gunshot wound. Yes, even this week, we amputated, we had to pay for someone's hand to be amputated. And this is because there's no first aid care, there's no emergency care. Those whose cases are terrible and they rush to the hospital. Just yesterday, we had to pay, a donor gave 200,000 for someone whose eye, he's 8 years old, and the gunshot, he was shot in the eye, and they were discharged last week. But the parents can't go home because the hospital won't allow them to be discharged because they've not paid. They lost their house. They lost an 11-year-old kid who was burnt to death in the same attack. Their other daughter is still in the hospital back home with a gunshot wound to the stomach. So these are stories. This is one family. So imagine what they're going through. The least the government can do for me is to even provide a hospital where they can be taken and treated for free. That's the least the government can do. But they don't do it. The second hard lesson I've learned in this, I mentioned the first one. The second one for me is that those who you're trying to help sometimes will stab you too. You know, help somebody and you think, he's supposed to be grateful. I mean, there are thousands of people that need help. So it's tough trying to pick who needs help the most because it's not like we have the resources. Mm-hmm. So you pick the person and then you find out the person is just trying to get more money off you, or after the initial intervention, they keep disturbing you with calls. Some even curse you out. They will literally call you to curse you out and tell you, don't think you did anything for them. You know. So yes, these are hard lessons that if I hadn't been there and experienced it myself, I wouldn't think these things would actually happen. You know, you hear them, but they don't really hit home till you're actually staring in the face of someone you're trying to help and is telling you to hell with your help.
Yes. And I think you just, you know, thank you for sharing those two lessons. But just on that second one is that, you know, that's why I salute you, because many people that do this type of work, you're even putting yourself in a vulnerable situation. You're putting your life in danger. You're going to danger zone areas. Then you go the extra mile to help people, and they, you know, they feel overprivileged. Some will even try to scam you and make up stories and say, you know, and try to gain, you know, other resources when there's other people that are even in more dire help than them. I'm very happy for, you know, just your transparency.
I'm sorry to cut you. You said something that triggered a memory in my head.
Yes.
You said some will make up stories. So there was this lady that made up the story. Well, it was someone else's story. It actually happened, but it didn't happen to her. Mm-hmm. So she was at the IDP camp one time, and then she heard about this lady who had to swim through a river to get to safety from the attackers. And then because her baby was too heavy for her on her back, she had to let go of the baby to survive, or two of them. Let go of her baby in the river, so the baby floated away and drowned, so she could cross over. It will make a mother, you know how they say mothers, anyway, I'm digressing. So she now came to us and gave us this story and said it happened to her. And then it was after we had collected, you know, the story resonated with so many people, so she got so much help and all that. And then it was later we found out it wasn't her. Nothing of that sort happened to her. But she came to us with a story, and we went ahead to provide the help and created awareness, and she was interviewed and stuff, and it wasn't her.
Yeah, and you see, that's the disheartening thing, because, you know, going to my point, there's so much fake news flying around. I even had a conversation, you know, a disturbing conversation with somebody here in the diaspora that said that, oh, no, you know, I shared, you know, statistics about how many people have been internally displaced in Nigeria. He said, oh no, we're one Nigeria, you know, like the government is perfect and there's no crisis, that, you know, it's just people making it up, you understand? Because he does not see, you know, I guess major media channels, you know, carrying the news, so he's looking like, oh well, you know, people are making it up. And, you know, my question to him was, how many states have you traveled to in Nigeria? When's the last time you've even been back to Nigeria? Have you ever talked to somebody that's been a victim of terrorism, of rape, of, you know, of violence, you know, anywhere, even if it's not in Nigeria, anywhere, you know? So I let him know, and I was just very, very hurt. And that was one of the reasons why I reached out to Safia, because us in the field, you know, we know what's going on. As you say, this is your service. This is your life service. You're one of our heroes, and you have been through a lot, but many people still don't know about it. So going to my next question of, you know, next month is June 30th, World Refugee Day, that the United Nations has declared. But the humanitarian crisis in Nigeria has still not been widely advertised. Thank goodness for social media. As you said, you know, many people have been using social media to be a voice to the voiceless. You know, your organization, RADI, you guys do interviews, and you're able to be, you know, a voice to a lot of these voiceless stories that nobody will hear if you don't stand in the gap. But many people to now still don't know, you know, okay, what's the difference between a refugee and a asylum seeker and the internally displaced person, you know, returnees? So how can we really, you know, go the extra mile this year and do something different, you know, for World Refugee Day? What is RADI planning to do for June 30th to really, you know, bring more light to the great work that you're doing, the humanitarian work that you're doing? And then also, you know, there's so much that still needs to be done. Over to you.
Okay. I think there is not much media coverage on it in Nigeria, because you talking about humanitarian crisis means you're telling the world the government isn't working. So they see it as an affront on their good deeds, in quotes. It's like they're giving out all the statistics of how great they're doing, the infrastructure they're trying to build and stuff like that. And then when you talk about the humanitarian part of it, they don't want to indulge you, and they want to shut you up. That's why a lot of my colleagues have been arrested, blackmailed, you know. A lot of things happen when they feel like you're speaking out. And then they see it like you're trying to make them look bad when you bring out stories like this. There was a time the chairman of a local government that we took relief materials to reached out and said he was in charge of something to do with the IDPs. And he needs to know who authorized us to go to his constituency to deliver material. And I wanted to be so angry, but I decided, okay, I need to record this conversation. So it was in message format. So I didn't want to go off all at once and then tomorrow maybe he will give it and say, oh, I didn't follow due process and stuff. So I asked him what's the procedure to follow if there are people who are hurting and there's blood everywhere and I want to go and deliver good relief materials to. What's the process? He should tell me the process.
Good.
And then he skipped the question and then he said how many bags of whatever, the quantity of things we took and how many, the number of people we catered to. And I said, you said they're your constituency. So go there, ask them what Radhi brought and ask them how many people were catered to. You can't come at me with these questions. And it's because of how he came. He came in a very rude, and that was at the height of them arresting us and stuff. So I was trying to be very careful with how I responded to him and how I... So they see you as an enemy. So the state wouldn't... it's not something you'll see the state or the federal government hyping or creating awareness about. In Kaduna State, for example, they don't even allow them to stay in camps. In 2019, in Kaduna local government alone, that's one community, there were 12,480 people in camps in just one community. And we hadn't even finished getting data when we woke up and the camps were empty because the government officials came and dispersed them. You know, they literally come after a few days. Because it makes them look bad to the outside world. You know, the outside countries start asking, what's happening? You say there's nothing happening. Why are there so many people in IDP camps? So because of that, they don't want people in IDP camps. There are no official IDP camps in Kaduna State as I speak. There are only places where victims have to run somewhere. So they run to usually the secondary or the primary school of the community that has been attacked, or anywhere safe that they gather for a few days, but they never stay there more than a week or two because the government will disperse them. They're not, it's a taboo to have the kind of gathering. And then what you can do to help create awareness, what Radhi is trying to do, it's just like what you said. When you just mention statistics, if I tell you now that there are 30,000 people in IDP camps, it doesn't really resonate. They're just numbers. So we're trying to put together short interview clips, you know, individual stories of people which resonates with people. You know, you look at a woman whose four kids were killed and she's narrating the story herself. Sometimes hearing from the victims themselves makes a lot of difference.
Yes.
So instead of collective stories of, there are 2,000 people in so-so-so place, you can say individual stories. And then that creates more awareness. It makes you refocus and shift your mind, you know, to the reality of while you're dropping your kids in school, while you're going to work and coming back, this is the reality of people on ground. These are human beings.
Yes. Yes. And it's just, you know, it's just really sad that, you know, you all have to even take up the work of media. You know, you have to do so many different skills. You're already doing humanitarian relief work, but I'm happy that, you know, you're able to now even try to get some of these individual stories of these victims and people that have been displaced through this humanitarian crisis in Nigeria, hearing firsthand from them. You know, they're not hearing secondhand, you know, thirdhand information. You're hearing it straight from somebody that experienced it, which, you know, as they said, you know, words, videos, you know, they speak more than thousands and millions of words, you know, when you hear that. So just big kudos to you and Radhi from really, you know, taking the risk and going into these areas is, you know, really even emotional draining on people like you that are even interviewing them and hearing all of these stories and seeing, you know, like the government and Kaduna that's saying, oh, no, you know, we don't want to, you know, support IDP camps. And they pretty much, you know, harass people that have been just victimized and traumatized. And instead of them providing shelter, providing a way, you know, for them to thrive back into the community, they put them in an even worse situation where many of them even, you know, that escaped death end up, you know, going back into very dire situations. So just thank you for that. And I look forward to seeing and also sharing a lot of those videos and stories with Nigerians and people here in the diaspora who are still not aware of the crisis that is happening back at home. We might be here in the diaspora, but we should not forget, you know, back at home. My mom and dad always said, you know, we're Nigerian Americans, but we're Nigerian first. There's no place like home, and we can never forget home. So thank you for, you know, really being a light in this very dark situation.
Thank you. Which gets me
to my next question is, you know, what steps did you take to get to where you are today? Many people, you know, don't really, you know, go into the humanitarian field because of the challenges, you know, the wahala that you explained earlier, you know, but what steps did you take to get there and stay on this track? Over to you.
The first step for me was integrity, because there's this widely spread notion that most people who are into humanitarian work only want to do it because they later want to go into politics. So they're just trying to gather goodwill so that they eventually drop it and then they go into politics. And then the scamming part of it, where you collect money from people and you don't do what you're actually supposed to do. So it was baby steps for me, especially because I didn't plan to be here. I've always done humanitarian work, but not on this scale. I just had about 2 or 3 people I was trying to pay their way through school and all that. But in 2019, my dad was arrested by the Kaduna State government. And that story for another day. I can't even go to that right now. He spent 103 days in prison. The case was thrown out eventually because of lack of evidence. So it was in digging into what led to my dad's arrest that I found out about the IDPs and the fact that they weren't being taken care of. So that was the first step for me. And two of the people who had a hand in my dad being arrested, he was charged for culpable homicide of Fulanis and cows because of the attacks. There was an attack in one of the villages in my community. And remember that there's never an arrest of the people. It's always unknown gunmen who come to do these atrocities and leave. They're bandits in quotes. But if you talk to people, victims, they will tell you they're Fulanis. So, and then there was a day we woke up and there were allegedly dead bodies of Fulanis on Adara land, by the way. I'm Adara by tribe from Kajuru local government. Okay. So the elders in the community were rounded up and arrested for the dead bodies allegedly found on Adara land, saying that we killed them. So that's just a little background of why my dad was arrested. But the case was thrown out of court. There was absolutely no evidence. It was thrown out for lack of evidence in court on May 31st in 2019. So it was when he was in prison, you know, as his daughter, I said, you know, what led to this? What's happening?
Yes.
So then I discovered the IDPs, and then two of the people that had a hand in it came to the house while I was sleeping too, because I was speaking out, I was advocating. As I was finding stuff out,
you were just speaking mad. Out. Yeah.
Yes, I was really upset. So I was saying a lot. I was creating awareness of what was happening, because a lot of people, I didn't even know till my dad got arrested that we were placed under a Hausa Muslim emir, even though we were 95% Christian Adara. It's ridiculous. Nowhere, they can't do that anywhere. Yes, so I was creating awareness about things like that. And so they came to tell my mom that I'm the reason why the elders are still in prison. I won't stop talking because what I'm saying is making the government look bad. So the government, they're bent on keeping them in prison to teach me a lesson, stuff like that. So they now dropped 50,000 naira with my mom. So I woke up, I was so mad because I did not understand why my mom even gave them audience. And my dad was still in prison at the time. So it didn't make sense for me that they were even saying what they were saying. So I was so mad that they even dropped 50,000 for us to do whatever. I don't even know why my mom collected it, but I collected the money from her. And then I went on Facebook and said, these two people came, but since they won't take care of the IDPs, I'm going to use the money they dropped to take care of the IDPs.
Good.
So anybody who has anything to add, I'll be seeing them in 2 days. There were two women at the time, Jumai and Rahila. At the time, they were at St. Gerard's Hospital in Kakuri in Kaduna State. Both of them had their left hands cut off. One had 4 kids slaughtered in front of her. Both of them were pregnant. Their stomachs were stomped until the babies died. Both of them have these huge scars on their neck because their heads were tried to be severed from their bodies. So it was a terrible story, and I only knew about it because Reverend Father Williams Abba posted it. He's in the US now. So the money I'm trying to gather will go to them. So whoever has, this is how Radhi was born. This was what gave birth to it. So I now said whoever had money, and in 2 days, I had about 380-something thousand naira. So I took it to the hospital. I took pictures and videos of me giving it to them. And then for everybody that gives in money, I wrote it on the post on Facebook. Because, you know, these are the steps that I think made us grow. The transparency of donations is very important, because I realized a lot of people want to give, want to help, but they're scared of their money going into the wrong hands.
Yes.
But at that point, my mind wasn't in growing Radhi or doing anything other than what I did that day. But after I took the money and gave them and came back to Facebook and posted me giving them the money, and people kept reaching out to me to still keep sending money. So I kept saying, no, I'm not going back. I have things to do, you know. I'm not going to keep going back. But reaching out. And so as they reached out, I kept giving out to different people. And that's how it just kept growing. And then it grew bigger than me. So I had to reach out to Ruben Buhari, who is my co-founder. He is more experienced. He has been in it for a long time. So because I wasn't experienced in running those kind of things, I now asked him for help. So he came in and we co-founded Radhi, and then we had it registered. And then a key thing we do is, you know, if you make a post now and say, oh, there's this child in the hospital in the US, maybe you want to help.
Yes.
And people just sending money. And then you come out and say, oh, they sent money and you've gone to give it. Some people will take it and, okay, they saw you take back the money. But I made it a point in Radhi, if we make a post and donations are coming in, 99%, no, they're anonymous. Mm-hmm. But if you go to the post, you'll see the number of donors and the amount that came in. You know, if four people gave 5,000 naira, you'll see 5,000 naira 4 times.
Yes.
Even if someone is trying to set you up somewhere, they can't get me there. So I'm very transparent with the donations that come in. And then another thing we learned to do, we're so busy now, we don't do it. We don't post as much as we used to. But of course, we still update. But instead of just handing over money, I could hand you 20,000 naira and tell the and write I handed 40,000. You'd never know because you saw me give money. So what I did for donors was I'd always send you a video of the victim saying the amount. So we have donors now that have been with us since 2019 because they trust that the amount they gave always reaches the victim.
The people.
Or whoever. Yeah. Yes. So we've tried to do that to build the integrity side of it, which is a huge, huge, huge factor in humanitarian work. It's always an issue. Even humanitarian partners, we've partnered with people who scammed us, who would use, we'll partner with them, provide, let's say, 100%. We had a medical outreach. We provided 100%. of the drug. Ben and I went to the market ourselves, bought the drugs ourselves, went to the village, and then we provided the clothes that were, three cars had to come and pack the clothes that were donated to Radi. And then the partners were supposed to handle the photography. And then when they made their post on their own websites and pages, there was no mention of Radi. So it looked as if
they did it on their own.
They brought the clothes. And I had to reach, I was so mad, but I didn't even make a deal out of it. So the person came back to want to have another partnership. And I said, look, this is what happened last time, and I'm never going to work with you again. Like, you're going to make it look to my donors as if I lied. Because if they go to your wall and see that, oh, you're saying you provided the medical drugs, then what did I do with the money that was given to me? Mm-hmm. You know, and then he was in charge of photography and video, so he has all the clips. I didn't, but luckily I still had the ones we had on our phones, and of course we had the receipts of us buying the drugs and all that. Good. So it's a lot. It took a lot to get here. So we're now registered. We now have a website. The registration was by a donor who saw our work and said, Aliri, you need to register this company, this organization. And I said, I don't have the money to do that. The money I'm using to register will help me start to build someone's house.
Right.
And he said, go find out. That's what I want to do. So he registered the organization. Another donor came and said, you need a website.
Yes.
And he paid. When people come ask us, who made your website? It looks so expensive. I said, I don't even know how much it costs to have a website. And the donor still pays every month to have it.
To host it, yeah.
Yes, to host it and then pay the person upgrading, you know, updating our stories and updating everything on the website. We don't pay a dime. You know, they're all from people who took it on themselves. So it's been a long road, and it's been a very teachable road. It's been a blessing. I've seen love like never before from people who don't even know me or don't have no affiliations with Kaduna. These are people that probably might never see these IDP. Mm-hmm. Or people do these things, you know, for humanity's sake.
And thank you just for that. Because I have worked in this humanitarian field and diplomatic field, I would say, for a very long time, Barbie, like 2 decades. And I'll just be honest and just keep it real. Many people that claim that they're, you know, helping IDPs and those that are, they're not. And for you to be transparent with the finances and even show, you know, because I've seen it. We have this many people that we've reached out to, this is how much money. But then when you go and, you know, and go and do, I've done site visits, and I'll say, okay, how much was given to you? You know, what was donated? You know, if, you know, we donated, let's say, some medicine, and then I'll go back and I'll find out, or malaria bed nets and everything, you'll be shocked that healthcare center, you know, that we donated, the MD there has his own private pharmacy chemist, and he took all the malaria bed nets. He did not give it out, the one that we donated. And so there's so many stories of that, but I thank God that Radi existed. And you know, you really told your personal story, and you brought it back to your professional and your purposeful calling, with you and your partner. You could have, you know, easily been like, okay, you know, I'm not gonna get into this. You know, your dad was arrested. They even came to your house, harassed y'all. They tried to bribe you. You know, these are ways where they could have silenced you and say, okay, let me just take this money, let me be quiet. You know, instead, you broadcast that, like, I don't want people to miss that point. She was able to turn a negative situation, which her father was in jail. You know, I tell people, I've been locked up 3 days, and I know how bad it is. And that's here in America. And I'm talking about, you know, in prisons and back at home in Nigeria. So to be in that situation, and that's what even birthed my, like, prison ministry of Bibles and everything. Because when I was locked up for 3 days, I asked them, oh, I want to have a Bible. I want to see the chaplain. They refused. And that was here in America. And they said, oh, and I asked afterwards when I was discharged. And I said, how come, you know, they said, oh, well, first of all, we don't even have enough Bibles. You know, a lot of organizations and churches that claim that they donate to prisons, many of those, they stopped donating, but they still claim on their websites. that, mm-hmm. oh, that this is how many, you know, money and Bibles is going into prison ministry. So that's the corruption that happens even here. So I know it's even on a higher level back at home. So despite all of that, you know, and all the personal traumas that you and your personal family, your dad and people in your community face, you said, no, you know, I'm not going to give up. So that gets me to my next question. How can us in the diaspora donate to you? You said $300,000. That's not nothing. I mean, $100, I think the exchange rate now is almost like $800. So just to put into perspective for, you know, people that are listening to the Wellness of Wahala podcast that don't understand, like $100 is like 80,000 naira. You understand? Which can go a long way. So how can us in the diaspora be able to donate to Radi and support here?
Okay, you can go to our website, www.radifoundation.org. Mm-hmm. The thing is, our Nigerian account numbers, it's difficult to you know, send money from the US abroad. And the UK.
Yes.
The hassle is too much, especially now with the new rules and all that. But I can send you the account numbers, but the easiest way, I think, is through the website.
Okay.
Because we have PayPal and other things. You just click on the donate button and then follow the steps. It's pretty easy.
Okay. Yeah. That is great. For those of us here in the diaspora, PayPal, they have a mechanism on their website. And even those of us here that I know, you know, still have Nigerian accounts back at home, you know, where they still manage and, you know, and their pension accounts, you can still, there's multiple ways.
We have people in diaspora, we have people in diaspora who reach out directly and then, you know, they have their people here send the money to us.
Yes.
So that does give the account number.
Yes. So please, everyone that is listening to this Wellness and Wahala podcast, I know that I'm going to personally donate on behalf of my podcast. Also, show is sponsored by Nigerian and Diaspora Organization, NIDO South Savannah here in Georgia. So I've also talked to our honorable president. So, you know, NIDO South Savannah, we will also, me and the president, we will also donate. Really appreciate the work that you're doing. And I know it is not easy. I have been to IDP camps. I have talked to victims of violence. This is the type of work me and Safiya was doing a lot, you know, and she was my media officer when we worked at Oxfam, and we were able to spread a lot of news, you know, on social media. And I think now she's with the United Nations, but still a lot needs to be done. You are really at the grassroots inside the communities. And you're just, you know, one of our heroes, you know, and you even covered my next question, which was, what qualities do you have as a hero? You talked about integrity. You talked about honesty, you know, transparency, accountability. And I just salute you. That gets me to my question of, how do you want to be remembered? What legacy do you want to leave in the community, not just, you know, through Radi, but just personally, you know, as a, you know, our Nigerian ambassador and hero that has been helping people, what legacy do you want to be remembered for? Over to you.
I'll keep it short. I just want to be remembered as a person who replaced terror with love.
Yes.
You know, I tell them all the time when I go to see them, I say, strangers came to you and cut off your limbs and killed your families, and you're here because of strangers, and I'm here because of strangers. The same strangers are still here to provide you with food, to pay your bills. Love will always cancel out terror. Like it's my thing. It's what I try to preach. No matter how evil or dark it gets, it can never ever cancel out love. Ever.
Whew. Love is the greatest, and I love that. Love will always cancel out terror. You know, I thank you for taking time out of, you know, this important interview to end your schedule. Thank you. Also, do you have any last words of advice? You know, who are some of your mentors that you look up to in this field, or any, you know, favorite quotes and last word that you want to share? Over to you.
My mentor in what I do, because I don't just see myself as providing humanitarian relief. I advocate, I see what I do as speaking out on behalf of these people who are not on Facebook, they don't have phones, who will be forgotten if we didn't keep telling people their stories and telling the world what is happening. So my hero in all of this will always be John Lewis. Because every time I want to give up or just feel overwhelmed, I always remember that if they hadn't done what they did, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't even be able to visit America. We wouldn't be where we are today as people, you know, Black people going to school in America for the first time. If people like John Lewis did not stand their ground, a lot wouldn't have been achieved.
Yes.
So his life and many others, of course, just gives me the push. Someone has to do the job. Someone has to do it. Not for you to be stupid, because again, you have to be careful. You can't be foolish in this advocacy or humanitarian work. If you hear there's a crisis happening, you can't wake up and go there because you want to help. You get killed and then what? So I learned from him to be careful. But there's a thin line, you know, you have to be careful, but you have to stand your ground to make your voice known. Like, you have to take a stand. You die if you keep quiet, you die if you talk anyway. So you have to go down fighting. Mm-hmm. And then his favorite quote for me has to be, there are several, aside good trouble, you know, that's what he's known for, the phrase.
Yes.
You know, there's good trouble.
So yes,
you'll rattle the government a bit, but it's good rattling. You're rattling for a positive reason. So he has this, I'm closing with this quote by John Lewis: take a long, hard look down the road you will have to travel once you have made a commitment to work for change. Know that this transformation will not happen right away. Change often takes time. It rarely happens at once. So it moves me. That end of quotes by John Lewis. This helps me always remember, I may not see the change. It may be slow. You might feed one family and then tomorrow you hear 100 people were attacked. So it looks like your work is not, like it's a needle in a haystack. Mm-hmm. But I always remember that I can't give up. I have to look back at where I started and where I am today. It's been a lot. Sometimes I hear people say things, or they reach out, or a family who we helped years ago will harvest their grains and bring them in bags. Like, oh my goodness, when I saw you in the hospital, I never thought I'd see the day you'd actually put beans in a bag and come to see me with it. So these are things that remind me. It may look slow, it may look like we're not doing anything, but I look at the people who we've touched and I know it's something. It's definitely something.
Whew. I mean, I can't follow after that. That is just so awesome. John Lewis is one of my favorite heroes. Also very well known here, from Georgia, congressman, and one of my good friends, Lovey Ajayi Jones. She also is a New York Times bestselling author of the book called Professional Troublemaker. So it is good, you know, and she said that book, you know, and she dedicated it also to him, you know, about good trouble. So thank you for being our public health hero and making good trouble in Nigeria and being a voice to the voiceless. I like using also African proverbs. So there's an African proverb in line with what you said, you know, love cancels terror. But that comes from Sierra Leone, which is, it is better to be loved than feared. Once again, it is better to be loved than feared. So thank you for just spreading your love and your light, and just being a voice of the voiceless humanitarian Wahala crisis in Nigeria. I salute you, I honor you, and I thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I wish you no wahala. and love and blessing this season. Blessing.
Thank you. God bless you. Thank you.
God bless you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, the Christians in the northern part of Nigeria are amongst the most persecuted in the world. But that is never, ever going to take away our praise and our worship. It makes us worship and praise God some more. So tonight, somebody shout, Nagore!
basune na kaoba Boni yara ya bone na ka Azurbara zi maria basune na kaoba Boni yara ya bone na ka Agaban kamai chitona Boni yara ya bone na ka
our VIP hero and honorable guest, Alhari Bawa Magaji. Thank you for being a voice of the voiceless and all your humanitarian service and showing love despite terror that people are experiencing in Nigeria. This song is dedicated to you, one of my favorites by Yemi Alade, which is Nagode. Thank you in Hausa, featuring Selo Bobo.
Oh, oh, Papa, thank you. Oluwa na gode o. Yemi alade ye sele popote da o chileke na gode o.
Person where hustle supposed to chop, he's supposed to pop, he's supposed to chill.
Yemi alade